Hello and welcome to the Evolve Pipedrive podcast. We talk all things Pipedrive, sales, apps, the Pipedrive marketplace. My name is Bruce Bignall. I own and run Evolve, a technology consultancy based in the UK, working globally. We specialise in helping scaling businesses do more with Pipedrive and their wider tech stack through implementation, consultancy and training in order to grow your business. We've recently launched our Evolve Sales OS, a free masterclass with over 4 hours worth of content from experts at Pipedrive, Surf, Just Call and Outplay. But today, though, I have the pleasure of being joined by Chima Mije, the Senior Content Marketing Manager at Moz. Moz builds tools that make SEO, inbound marketing, link building and content marketing easy. Now, I'm really looking forward to this conversation with Chima for a number of reasons. One, I don't know if Chima, you know this, but I'm an SEO man myself, having worked in enterprise SEO and SaaS businesses before. And for a digital marketing agency based, that actually started the Brighton SEO. Secondly, because I quoted Chima in a recent talk that I gave at the London Business Show, talking about sales technology for 2024. I quoted a LinkedIn post that she gave before I'd even met Chima that stated, if your marketing budget for 2024 does not include AI training for your teams, then you're making a big mistake. AI is the present and the future. So train your teams to use them properly, and I promise you'll see the results in efficiency. And now here we are in real life speaking. And three, because Chima has just posted her 27 predictions for SEO for 2024. I'm looking forward to touch upon some of those today and extract some of the insights from that. So Chima, without further ado, welcome. Please can introduce yourself and Moz to our audience before we dig in.
Bruce, thank you so much for having me and for that bumpy, great introduction. My name is Chima Mije. I am the Senior Content Marketing Manager at Moz. I'm also the founder of a nonprofit called the Freelance Coalition for Developing Countries. I do content marketing, I do content strategy, I do content writing, all of all that fun content stuff. I'm always there. And Moz is a great tool. Like you said, it's a SEO tool, all-in-one SEO toolkit. If you're just getting started, if you're advanced, if you're an agency, Moz is great for doing keyword research, for building links, for finding gaps in your content. Honestly, whatever the SEO task is, you can definitely use Moz to achieve that goal. And I'm really excited to dig into how we can future-proof our content heading into 2024.
Yeah, awesome. So I do have some questions for you. This is people that normally listen to this might be thinking, what's SEO got to do with kind of Pipedrive or CRM? Actually, SEO and content should be at the heart of not just a business owner, but even from a sales team. So what content are they putting out, as well as the types of conversations you can have internally with your marketing team? So Chima, if you don't mind, I do have 10 questions I'd like to go over with you in order to help our audience, you know, future-proof their content strategy for next year. So how can you leverage AI for content creation and automation?
So I'm just going to go back to that LinkedIn post that you referenced. I do believe that AI is present, AI is the future, and you need to be using AI at this point. Like if you work in sales, if you work in any marketing function, you're not using AI yet, I feel like you're sleeping and you need to wake up immediately and start using AI. So I think the key thing is to understand what can you automate, understanding the ethical considerations and understanding what you should not be automating. So you need to be having those three things in every conversation when you talk about automation, because if not, you run into the risk of just automating everything and then that's just lazy. So a few things that you can automate from I'm a content person, so I'm looking at this from a content point. One of the first things I ever did with AI was automating keyword research. I just wanted to see, I have my own keyword research that I've done manually. Can I use AI to find something that I have missed? So I can do my manual keyword research with tools like Moz. I can extract that list. I can clean up that list. And then I can feed that list as a spreadsheet into a tool like ChatGPT. And then just ask it to look over this keyword research that I've done. maybe feed it also a competitor keyword list and then say, help me find gaps around all of these topics that I'm trying to build for clusters. And then it can just like look at my own list, look at the competitors list, and then find things that I may have missed when I was doing that manual research, because I'm human and I'm fallible. I can also use AI tools to do topic generation. It's something I do a lot of. And this is usually when I'm trying to build like clusters, and I've done the manual work, but I'm trying to see if there's anything I've left out. And I can say to ChatGPT, I have this list of topics targeting keywords at the top, at the middle, at the bottom, and post-purchase. Is there anything that I've left out that we should be discussing based on our audience interest? And then I feed it that audience interest. And then it can start to give me results that I can add to what I already have. So with anything I'm doing around automation, it's usually that I've done the background work, I've done the manual work, and then I just want to use AI tools to complement my efforts so that there's absolutely no gap. I also use it for like optimization. After I've written the content, or even before writing the content, I want to find entities that I can add to the content to provide context for search engines so that they know how to rank the page and it's optimized for as many keywords as possible that are relevant to the overarching theme that we're trying to cover. We can also use it to understand user intent. We can always use it to like extract NLPs, which is, I think, is becoming very important as we are heading into a period of conversational content.
So talk to me about NLPs in this context. What do you mean by that?
So NLPs is basically natural language processing. Now, how do I approach this? There are two sides to this. You have conversational tools like Google SGA. You have conversational tools like ChatGPT. All these AI tools that are coming out right now, they're all conversational. It's that you put one question, it gives you an answer. If you don't like it, you keep moving on from there, and then it just becomes this really long thread. It's conversational. We're also seeing that with voice assistants that are even becoming, realized, so good. So NLP basically helps you to optimize your content for words that sound natural, words that are used in conversations basically, so that your content is optimized for those conversations, so that your content is optimized for voice searches. What would somebody say if they were trying to make a purchase? How would they say it to a voice assistant?
This is quite interesting, right? So this,
yeah,
I haven't thought about this for a long time, but this is the, no longer do you have to match the exact keyword, because the natural language processors, or the even the large language models, understand the context of what you're trying to say. So then in old world SEO, what are the long tail keywords that might drive what we all thought 2020 was going to be the year of voice search?
Never really took off.
But what the insight came from that was actually to what you're saying there, I assume with the NLP, it's actually the intent to what you're trying to say. So if you're asking for something, what's the intent? How can a search engine respond the question around that? And I'm talking about Brighton SEO. I've seen some of the talks. John Earnshaw talks about owning the SERPs and the SERP universe. So they've asked one question, but are you actually asking about this, or are you actually asking about that? And then is that what the NLP would be in your eyes?
I actually gave a talk at Brighton SEO on the importance of owning the SERPs. That was in April. I did give a talk about that still, on owning the SERPs.
I missed that one, sorry.
Yeah, no worries. So it's not just about, I don't think this is more like owning the SERPs. This is, I don't want to use owning the SERPs, because then that just looks like we're just optimizing for topics. You're optimizing for conversations. So it's focused on long-tail conversational keywords and how people naturally speak and ask questions. Do you see the difference? How would somebody say something in the conversational format if they were asking a question and they were looking for answer? That is what we need to be optimizing for. So you can optimize for that. You can actually use AI to like find those kind of queries. There are so many tools. I think like Answer the Public. There's this one. there's this one that I forgot the name of the tool, but hopefully I remember before we end this conversation, that does that. And there's just so many tools out there that you can use to find questions that people are asking around the topic. So that is what you need to be optimizing for. The question that people are asking in a way that sounds natural, in a way that sounds conversational, and then optimize for that in your content. Make sure you're answering those questions in your content so that when people are asking questions with voice assistants, when people are asking questions with like SGA, with like any of these new conversational generative chatbots or AI tools, your content is optimized to show up for them, especially now that they are giving that they're linking back to the sources of this content. So let's say SG is speaking of content from this source or this source. You can always notice that even with bad, they're like linking to the sources. So I think search is changing now. Search is changing from just trying to rank for like feature snippets or for like the top 10 results to trying to rank for content that will show up on on Binge, on Binge AI, on Google SGA. It's shifting, and you can use AI tools to prepare for that. Those are the kind of stuff that will be automating. So what not to automate in the other side of the coin would be the parts that requires expertise. I use ChatGPT a lot, and I always say this, that the reason why people are getting bad results with ChatGPT is that they are trying to get ChatGPT to think for them, and they're trying to make ChatGPT the expert, but it is not an expert. It is basically like garbage in, garbage out. It's taking what already exists and it's giving it back to you. So it is you, the expert, that's supposed to use your lens as the expert to take what you're seeing from tools like ChatGPT, from like Google SGA, and then rephrase that into your personalized experience. So it's supposed to just be like something to like spark creativity, something to like help you jumpstart an idea, but it's not supposed to finish off that thought process for you. It's not supposed to write that expertise for you. I think that's the thing that's going to set content apart going into 2024. It's content written from the first person viewpoint.
Yeah, I completely agree. And we'll get upon that with some of the points around that first-party content, first-party data and things like that. So that's a really good insight, because I'm seeing this now, that right now it feels like the wild, wild west of everyone using the AI tools, but then there'll be a level playing field, a leveling out of the amount of content without even getting into the idea of Google labeling AI generated content as synthetic, without kind of getting into that territory. I think that the getting into a position where it's not the buzzword top 10 lists, the BuzzFeed top 10 list of top 10 this, top 10 that. It's this is how I do it. So that,
yes,
that's how it's get
it. This is, yes, so then, that's that is it. I think I made a post a few days ago that skyscraper content is dead. That's because it relies on expertise of others. You just pull from this, and then you don't even form an opinion. You just paraphrase what all these other people have said, and then you write it as your content. And if you have like great domain authority, or you've built like some backlinks, then you rank for that piece of content. But what I'm seeing now is that to filter out automated content, search engines want to see expertise.
Yeah, demonstrate your expertise. Okay, so let's, if you want to demonstrate your expertise, what would be some strategies to kind of scrape together a marketing campaign or even a marketing content strategy on a budget? Because a lot of the audience here are either business owners of small businesses, or they're part of a business that's scaling, but they might not have a marketing department just yet. So could you give some...
I feel like I think scrappy marketing is back in play next year, as we're going to probably see some more cuts with jobs in marketing because of automation. And the way to do scrappy marketing is to look inwards instead of looking outwards. What is in our channel that we can use to create content and reach our audience? So the first thing, obviously, is your blog. Are you creating like experts driven content? Are you platforming internal sources? That is the first step. So if you're doing this, you're already on the right path to creating, I don't want to say scrappy content, but optimizing, not optimizing, that's not even the right word, but creating content that is within a budget. Platform internal experts, it's free. Get them to write content based on the keywords you're trying to rank for, and make sure that you're creating autobios from everyone and you're linking to that autobio. Already right there, that's already expertise. That's already first person written content. I would say that the next one would be partnerships. This is harder, but also but it always pays off, because sometimes you don't even have to pay for partnerships if you build the right relationships. So you can leverage partnership for like co-marketing. What can we, how do we partner with you? Maybe through something like this, like what we're doing, a podcast, a webinar series. Maybe we have tools that feed off each other. Just think of ways that you can collaborate. Maybe it's a social media campaign as a way to feed off each other's audience. You can also look at referral marketing, maybe offer incentives for people who refer customers. I use Revolut for my banking. Revolut is always promising me £150 if I refer somebody for the business account. That's like free marketing. If someone opens a business account, and even if they put like some money in there, over time, the value, Revolut is going to get that value of £150, like maybe 10-20x that amount. So it's like an easy way for them to like get people to refer new customers. You can also look at SEO. Even if you have a very small LinkedIn, I feel like SEO should be part of that small LinkedIn, because it's an expensive mistake that you don't want to make, and you want to have that foundation right there. Also on looking inwards, your email list. Are you building an email list? Are you sending out newsletters? Are you providing personalized communications? Are you providing value to your audience and plugging in your product in the right way? What about your social media channels? Are you also using your social media channels to create content, to engage with your audience, to participate in community discussions? The center of all of this would be your blog. And then from your blog, you can take that content and then repurpose it in like bite-sized formats, or like do like guest posts, or do co-marketing, or any of this stuff I just talked about. Mm-hmm. But the center would be your blog, and then everything else, email, social, everything else would just feed off this. Even if we had to start like a podcast, but everything you would do would start with looking inwards instead of looking outwards to like search engines and all of all that stuff.
And just demonstrating your expertise again. Yes. To your point, would you have that content live on your site as the blog first? Yes. First.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah.
Absolutely. I see people, I don't know what it was, but I saw some people, some SaaS companies that were creating their blog on Medium. And for the life of me, I did not understand what that was. That was absolute madness for me. Medium is not your platform. There is no reason why you should be hosting your blog on any site, or even publishing content on LinkedIn first, like the LinkedIn blog, instead of publishing the content first on your blog and then republishing on LinkedIn. Doesn't make any sense.
I love it. Tell me what you really think. I love it. This is great. So talking about AI again, how would you look to build this? Would become an internal project, I assume, or so they can either do this in-house or they can do it externally, like with some partners. And we have some partners for AI training. But what would you say is an effective team training tool for someone to begin with AI, using different AI tools?
I think, first of all, I would definitely consider looking at, again, if you don't have a lot of budget, I would look at who internally is already doing like really incredible stuff with AI. That would be somebody to train the team. If you have someone who internally who has been experimenting, who is already like slowly building their own like AI tech tool stack, that's where you want to start your training from, because they know your tool, they know your SaaS software, and they found ways to use AI tools to automate their job and make it better. So that would be like the first place to start. If you have the budget, then you can bring in somebody who specializes in that AI training to train your team on, one, what are we doing manually right now? Can it be automated? Is it worth it automating it? Or is this something we want to keep doing manually? How do we use AI tools to support strategic thinking, so that it's merging with our skill sets but it's not replacing you, because obviously AI can replace you. And how do we use AI tools to make data-driven decisions? How do we use it to stay competitive? How do we use it to create an agile content or SEO framework? How do we use it to enhance creativity and innovation? I think this is like the main thing. How do we use AI tools to improve our creativity, enhance innovation, and automate manual tasks that can be, that are repeatable, that we can be automating? And then, very, very important, what are the ethical considerations that we should be looking at when we're using AI tools on a day-to-day business?
So that's the second time you've raised that. So what would you, where, from the ethical standpoint and what to consider going into 2024, what are two or three ethical considerations to think about? Is it from the data collection? Is it from putting out content saying it's yours when it's not yours? Like, where do you sit on that?
I think it's a very, very gray area, because if you're using AI to write content, you know, if you're using AI to write content, then you can assume that what it's generating is coming from multiple sources. So you want to make sure that you're running that content through a plagiarism software. Just make sure that you're not regurgitating what somebody else has created word for word. You want to also be looking at it and saying, if this is somebody else's content, is there a way for us to I don't want to say rewrite it, but is there a way for us to like paraphrase what the person have said and then add our own expertise in here so that it feels like our content and not somebody else's content? You also want to understand, like, where is it getting its data from? Is the data true? You want to be validating the information always, and this is where expertise comes in. Are you validating what the AI tool is giving you? Are you making sure that this content is correct? Are you making sure that it is not just making stuff up, because you know that these AI tools tend to do that sometimes? And you also have to consider the bias sometimes that happens with using AI tools. Are you reading the content that is generating through the lens that, okay, this might be biased from one viewpoint? That's why sometimes when ChatGPT generates stuff, you can ask it to show you the sources or to regenerate with sources so that you can go back and look at where it is getting the content from. So these are just some things to consider ethically when you're using AI. And if you're an agency, for example, or you have a responsibility to your clients, then maybe you want to let them know that you are using AI in creating the content for them.
And just on that point about sources, be sure to ask it, are they real sources?
Yes.
Have you made them up? And
I would call it to regenerate and use real sources and link to the sources.
Yeah.
That when it regenerates, it just gives you like the link, and then I can click on that and make sure that this is a real website.
Yeah, because it can be a bit naughty. It can be a bit naughty, and because if you ask the question, did you make anything up, and only use real sources, it can say, actually, yes, I did make some up. you hit that one for me. But just on AI, and you talked about kind of being AI data driven. One of my questions here was, how can you be hyper personalized with using AI? But for data analysis, right? So is that at scale? Tell me a little bit what you would lean into that.
So I think, first of all, let's dial back and look at why you should even be considering hyper-personalization. You should be considering hyper-personalization because if we're joining the content, then people are looking for stuff that relates directly to them as a way to filter out the noise. So a few ways to do that is to make sure that you're collecting diverse data sets from multiple sources, like website interactions, social media activity, purchase history, customer feedback. All of this information can help you to better understand your customers. And instead of just having the generic segmentation that is like up here, you start to bring it down on a granular level so that you can have like even more personalized segments when you're sending out emails, when you're creating content, and all of all that. So you can now start to segment even deeper for demographics, for behavior, for psychographics, which allows you to do more targeted content creation. Now, you can now optimize, sorry, you can now even customize on a more deeper level. So let me just use an example now. Let's say at Moz, instead of just creating content for one broad niche, we can now start to say, okay, we want to create content for agencies, or want to start creating content SEO for lawyers or for like legal people and folks like that, you know. Now, if we create that content, it's not just SEO anymore. We can even go deep and say, how should lawyers build backlinks for their websites? Because the framework that applies to lawyers might be different for that for other industries, you know. So that would be one way of doing hyper-personalization. You would have the stuff that works at the top for everybody, but then you will start to drill in deeper and much deeper, both on a topical level and both on an audience level, to make sure that you're serving like very small, tiny niches. But I think that's even more effective if you're trying to reach more people in 2024. It's just a lot more work, but it actually works. So let me just go back to what I've said. You're gathering your data from multiple sets, website interaction, social media activity, purchase history, customer feedback. You're using AI tools to analyze this large data set and to find patterns about customer preferences and behaviors. Then you're segmenting into smaller groups, smaller granular groups, to allow for more targeted content creation.
I think that's really important, and it goes back into just kind of linking it back into the sales audience that might be listening to this at the moment, where I know Google have backtracked on what they were saying about email outreach, certainly for B2B networks next year. But I hope it's just allow people to think you can't just buy data sets of 5,000 to 10,000 people and then just kind of hyper-personalize to 10,000 people. Why not have a list of 200 people where there might be lawyers in a region, and you know you can help those lawyers in that region. Like that for me would be the hyper-personalization, having a list of 200 people where you can really deliver some real impactful messaging and which might land, versus much broader personalized at scale. All that means is there's a personalized intro to 5,000 people.
Yeah, I agree. Except if you have a way to break down the psychographics of that 5,000 people, so that you can then put them into segments. Because what we have is people just buying email lists and then just sending out emails to them, see who opens an email and report on that. But if there's a way to break down, to get more than just their emails, to get enough information or psychographics too that you can use to glean deeper into that customer and then put them into granular segments, then it becomes more powerful than if you were just sending out generic emails to 5,000 people.
Yeah, I was listening to a podcast the other day. I think it was the head of growth at ActiveCampaign, and he was talking similar realm to this, where he said they no longer, as an indicator of SaaS size, to like lifetime value of a company at the beginning, they no longer use the size of the company as an indicator of like the number of people in the business as an indicator of what it will mean to them. Because you can have solopreneurs that are sending out 2 million emails a month, or teams of 3 people that have mailing lists where they're sending out 5 million emails, versus a 200-seater lawyer firm that don't communicate it in that manner. So it was actually a very bad measure. So the reason I give that as a bit of context, because I think what you capture at the front end and from a customer journey standpoint, when the touch points that you can extract from them, what are they interested in? What's their use of your system or your systems that you may have in your, I guess, network? That might, if the more you can collect along that customer life cycle with them, the more you can hyper-personalize against them. I would say on that. Good point. So just on that, about one of my other questions here is about credibility. So how could you build thought leadership and trust and credibility going into 2024, given what we've just said about hyper-personalization and being an expert in your field, using AI to build thought leadership for trust and credibility?
Okay, so first of all, again, I always try to go back to why we need to do something. So why do we need to even build thought leadership? And why do we need to build expertise? Again, it's because of AI. It's because of all of all this content that we're seeing around. And it's the response of Google has been the helpful content update. Basically, it's just platforming people that it considers experts. So what can you do? How can you create more thought leadership content? I actually wrote a piece on the Moz blog about about this, because I was already seeing the trends, and I was like, I needed to create something that would help people to build that thought leadership strategy going into 2024. So the first thing I would say to do is to set a goal. That's always the first place to start. What do you want to get out of thought leadership? For someone who works in SaaS or who works in sales, many people want to build thought leadership as a way to get in front of an audience and sell without selling. That means that they want to build an audience that attracts organic traffic. It could be through social media. It could be through doing public speaking. It could be through guest posting on big websites that get a ton of traffic. You know, whatever you're doing, there has to be a goal in sight for you. For me personally, I started building thought leadership because I wanted to get people to come to me and say, I want to work with you, rather than me going out to meet them and saying, do you want to work with me? There's a difference there. When people come to me organically, it's always easier to convince them because they don't actually need convincing. They've already done the homework and they believe that I'm the best person for the job, compared to when I go to them and there's skepticism and I have to convince them about who I am and why I'm the best person for the job. So you see what thought leadership can do. I'm going to use Gong as an example. There are two people at Gong that are very popular. I know one is, I think, Chris Reed, and the other one is, I've forgotten his name, but there are two of them, very popular guys working for Gong. I didn't even know what Gong was until I started seeing their content on LinkedIn. That was how popular they were. Because of these two people, I'm pretty sure hundreds, if not thousands of folks have signed up to try Gong because of how popular their content is. So you can use that, creating content on LinkedIn, but creating the kind of content that positions you as an authority on a topic. That's always the key thing to do. You can't just create any kind of content. You have to create content around what you're trying to build authority on. So if your thing is lead generation, then you need to be creating content around that. What are all the other subtopics around lead generation? If your thing is SaaS, then you need to be creating content around that. What are the problems that maybe Series A companies have, Series B companies have? All of all those type of stuff, that's the content you'll be creating. Whatever your thing is, you create that content on your blog, you create that content on social media, you take that content on podcasts, on webinars, you take that content to speak at events, you just be everywhere at once, basically saying the same thing over and over again, because it is repetition that is going to make your message stick. And then you make sure you call yourself the thing you want people to call you. And that starts usually with your social media profiles and then all your auto bios.
That's might be the most powerful thing that comes out of this session. I think for people to listen to that, refine your message, know your message, what your offering is, and repeat it on every platform.
Yes.
That might be the biggest takeaway for people.
Yes, you keep saying it over and over again until people associate that thing with you. You wonder when they think of that word, whatever it is, or that problem, you're the first person that comes to mind.
So if you're going to start creating user-centric content to meet specific intents or needs there, I think that leads on quite nice. That was one of my questions here, and that leads on quite nicely to what we were just talking about there. So, crafting a user-centric content to meet specific intent. How would you leverage AI for that?
Okay, I think this is very straightforward. You can put in a query and just ask AI, "What is the intent of this keyword?" And then it can tell you that intent. If you have like a bunch of keywords, I think you can plug in that spreadsheet or that list of keywords, and then say, what are the intents of this? If there are any keywords that have multiple intent, because sometimes a keyword might have commercial and maybe navigational intent, asks you to specify where it has multiple intents, and then it gives you that intent. Then you can even go a bit further and say, what type of content would fit this intent? So if it's showing you that this is a commercial query, sometimes commercial queries might require a landing page, and then sometimes it might also require a blog post. You can use AI to determine what type of content you should be creating for that content. So this is actually very straightforward. Get your list of keywords and then plug it in and say, what's the intent and what type of content do I need to create to optimize for this intent?
It is amazing that you can do that. I guess it used to be the sentiment analysis of social tweets and things like this, right? But now, that was only for the most expensive SaaS platforms and the biggest businesses. But it's available to everyone now, which is really very, very cool.
Yep.
So the power of original research. We've touched upon this a couple of times, but the power of original research and data-driven insights, where should that fit within kind of someone's plan for next year? Because you've said a couple of things here. So everything should be expert-led. So the AI isn't driving the damn thing. It's the autopilot to the pilot, right? So it's the pilot still gets in, is there for safety, there to take off and land. But so if AI is your partner or your co-pilot, what's the power of original research and data-driven insights?
Okay, so the reason why you actually need to be creating original research is that you want to be creating content that AI cannot replicate. Not in 5 years or 10 years or ever is AI going to be able to create original research, because you need to get feedback from people, or you need to get answers from real people, collect that data, analyze it, and then create your research. That is the power of original research as we're going into an AI-driven madness world next year. So that means that you need to be doing that research. First of all, you want to identify, what do we want to do that research on? Okay, what is the biggest problem that we are solving for our audience? That already gives you an idea on what you should be doing your research around. I'm going to give an example. I think it was something Gamble. I can't remember their name. Deep Gamble, I think. Let me see. Deep Gamble. Yes, Deep Gamble NFT. So they did this research on dead NFTs. It went viral. And basically it was talking about how most of the NFTs that people had bought are dead.
Yeah.
95% of NFTs are dead. That was huge. That was massive. That was like land scale research level. Got like, I think, 1 million likes on Instagram, on YouTube. It just went viral. If you create that kind of content, I never ever heard of Deep Gamble before until that
research.
I didn't even know who they were until that research. So what it does is that it brings it into a new audience. Why? Because all these media outlets picking up your research and publishing it, they're giving you links back to your website. They're introducing you to their audience. People are discovering you for the first time. The people who already know you are now seeing you as an expert on this topic. You now become a trusted voice in your industry. This is why you should be creating that research. So the first step is always to understand, what is the problem that we are solving for our audience, and how do we create original research around that? Research is not cheap. I think from everybody I've spoken to who does this as a service, it's not cheap. The person I saw who was the cheapest was $5,000. If you have someone in-house who can lead this, great, but I would advise working with an expert on this. It's not a service I provide. But once you've identified the topic, then you want to collect the data. This is actually the difficult part, finding people to contribute to your research, especially if you're doing something that requires doing a survey. Once you get that data,
How do you have any recommendations to lean in, or what is that kind of give? So yeah. What is that? Do you have any recommendations there?
I think there was one we did where we were giving people like saying as a thank you, they're giving like $50 Amazon gift card. But not everybody has $50.
Not everyone has that type of money to give.
Yes, to like a draw and say, if you fill out this, we enter into a draw for like $200 gift card, you know. So everybody feels that, with the hope that they might win.
Okay. Yeah.
Gift card, you know, that's cheaper because it's now incentive to contribute. Some people might say, okay, we'll build like 500 trees somewhere. If you fill this, or for every submission we get in the survey, we build it, we plant a tree, or we do something for a charity, you know, you just want to appeal to people in a way that incentivizes them. Because these days I'm realizing like that just telling people to fill a survey, especially if it takes more than a minute, is difficult. So, and you also want to get the right people for the survey. You want to get people who are related to the field of your study, or else it doesn't work. Then comes the part that I think is most impactful, is analyzing it and then bringing out the insights that matter to your audience. If you can do that, if you can find that insight and then present it in a way that is visually appealing, that is where graphics come in, then you've got a winner on your hands. Because the next part is working with digital PR to get it in front of all the right people and make sure that everyone is seeing the hard work that you've done. The thing with research is that it doesn't just live on its own. You can take one insight and write a blog post on it. Take another insight, write another blog post. Take one more insight, turn it into a speaking engagement. Take another one, go and do it as a podcast or as a webinar. You just keep taking insight one by one, and it just keeps becoming its own content.
Yeah. And then even the year after, you can say how things changed.
Yes.
did the predictions live up to itself? Yeah,
it's just so many opportunities, so many things you can do with the research reports. So many things. I call it the gift that keeps on giving.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's such a good something. Sorry, that is so important to remember, right? Because marketing teams can feel like they put a lot of effort into to launch this for a launch event for this one thing, this one blog, this one ebook, this one report. And they kind of, there's all this hype before it. You collect all the details before it launches, you pre-register, it's now live, you send it out in your first mail blast, then what? Well, actually, that wasn't the launch wasn't the point. The long tail, and if you... bad example possibly, but if you think about what used to happen, that you would have exclusive access to movies when they first came out. You would have to pay for the entry fee to go to the cinema, so then you could go to the cinema. If the word of mouth then meant people went there, and that's how you got the movie business, Hollywood, right? that's how that works. But then in the 90s, or even before that, you also had the long tail of sales. So if it wasn't a big hit at the box office, you actually still have a huge hit on your hand for the Universal Studios because of VHS and DVD sales in that long tail. So it wasn't a... Yes, you have your opening weekend box office, but then you have... How do you keep that going and monetizing that for the next decade or next summer?
Yes.
But that is a very kind of tangential thing. This isn't what you just said there isn't it's a principle that once something goes live, you can repurpose it and resell it and, you know, chop it up a million ways. So I thought that's really, really useful. I'm conscious of your time now. I do have some other questions, so if you don't mind, Chima, we'll keep cracking on. I love your answers and your energy. This is great.
Yeah,
so
sure. Go on.
In terms of structuring your content, across, we talked about owning your own content and different channels. We've heard of the concept of the medium is the message. So if you were to structure your content for snippet optimization, for example, how would you go about thinking about that?
Okay, so I think feature snippet is so important because obviously it's at the top of the search results. The easiest way, I would start with when you're defining something. Let's say you're writing an article about sales pipeline, and you have a subheading. Your first H2 says, what is sales pipeline? The words under that immediately should be sales pipeline is, then you have maybe like 50 words defining a sales pipeline. But before you even define it, you want to look at the SERP and see, okay, is there a featured snippet already for that? That tells you that, okay, you can grab that featured snippet and then look at how they've defined it before you even define yours. You want to try and do two things, reverse engineer what they've done and also make it your own. I know it sounds difficult, but it's two things you have to combine. So basically, you want to keep the meaning of what the person has said, but now use your own words to define that. That's the first way. If you have a list that says top five sales prospecting tools, I think what would help is having a number list. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and it just goes down like that.
Yeah.
You want to make sure that your formatting is good, because that formatting is going to help search engine bots to like pick up that text for future snippets. You also want to be optimizing for conversations. Like I said, those conversational queries. And you can do that by looking at Google's People Also Ask, by looking at, by using NLP to find those long tail, long tail keywords that people are asking questions around. And then thinking to yourself, how do I answer this question naturally in the text? Because search engine bots can actually pick that up. When you write, make sure that the language you're using is clear, is direct, and it's concise. You cannot start writing for the sake of it or being long-winded. You just want to be clear and concise as possible so that it can pick up that brief answer that you've given and then serve it in steps as the answer. And oh, sorry, finally, structured data. Please, always use structured data.
So I just want to define two things there. So SERPs would be search engine ranking position.
Yes.
And structured data would be, this is for the audience. And
I don't know. Structured data is structured data.
So I would, are you talking about using schema or?
Schema markup.
Yeah,
I don't know. It's always hard for me to like break it down. But yeah, structured data is the same as schema markup. For example, maybe blog schema, video schema, FAQ schema, whatever it is you are trying to optimize for, make sure you're using that schema based on the type of content that you are creating.
Yeah. Again, I just want to make it as actionable as possible.
Yeah, my bad. My bad.
No, that's cool. Two more here. So in terms of building high quality backlinks, which we touched upon this a couple of times, there's obviously the importance of your what we said today is the importance of having your content live first on your website and then going off onto the socials. But then the other side of that is building high quality backlinks with other authoritative sites. So what would be your top tips looking into the new year to build high quality backlinks for improved ranking?
First of all, start with your own content. You want to create linkable assets. Research reports are like top of that list for me, because every time I've seen someone talk about how we build blah 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 1,000 or 100 number of backlinks, there's always a research report tied to it. Digital PR will be one of those ways. If you create linkable assets like a research report, like a downloadable asset, like the random post that we just did on Moz, the one that features 27 SEO and content posts giving their prediction, that's a linkable asset. People are going to go back to their website and then say, oh, we got featured on Moz. This is the link to go and read the article. So first of all, think of how you can create linkable content, because that can feed your outreach. Next, I would say guest posts still work. I don't know, it still works. It's going to work for a long time to come, because high authority websites need expert authors, and you can be one of those expert authors if you have a great pitch for them. Also, I would say build relationships. You can never overestimate the importance of having like great relationships for partnerships. It really comes in handy if you're trying to like jump on someone's podcast, do a webinar with them, do co-collaboration content. Partnerships are so helpful for that. What else? Awards are great. If you've done a very, very good campaign, write a case study about it, shout it from the rooftops, use that case study to pitch for a speaking event, use that case study to pitch a podcast, use that case study to create a webinar series. People eat up case studies because it's real. It's not made up. But I'm always surprised when I see people just write a case study and just leave it on their website, or they win an award and they leave it on their website. Like, you want to make sure that you milk the heck out of that for as much link juice as possible. Again, if you have a digital PR team, you won an award, your digital PR team can can outreach or like reach out to their journal partners to get that featured on news websites, because that's a big deal. So I would say these are like the, off the top of my head, these are the ones I can think of. Win an award, milk that out with digital PR, publish your research reports, make that with digital PR, and also make sure you're turning that into different content formats. You publish your case studies, and then make sure you're pitching that to speak at events because you will get a backlink. Make sure you're submitting that to award sites because it improves your credibility and it also earns you a backlink. Make sure you're pushing that to podcasts and other places where you can speak on it. And yeah, that would help. An outreach, good old-fashioned outreach. The response rate is going down. I was seeing someone saying that it's like 3%, less than 10% now, but still works.
I think it's great. I was just thinking there how much value you've shared on this call so far. So my last question in terms of 2024 outreach would be continuous monitoring and adaptive content strategies. So let's say you've started this, and to your point just there, oh, the response rate isn't quite what I wanted it to be in March, but you know, and you've been doing this for 3 months. What would you say to continuous monitoring and adaptive content strategies?
So let's say you put out a piece of content and you've waited like a month or two and you're going back and it's not yet performing well. First of all, you want to make sure and ask yourself, what was our goal for this content? That's always the first thing. If it's not achieving that goal, then let's review the content from the lens of that goal. So you want to go back and look at all the other folks who are ranking and then put your content side by side their content and see what they are doing well that you've not done. Have you built enough backlinks? Sometimes I think that's usually the first thing I've noticed, is that content can be so well written and still not rank if it doesn't have enough links from the reputable sources that are in your industry. So you need to have a solid link building strategy, first of all, because I rarely ever see anybody who builds enough backlinks, creates good content, and it doesn't get to rank. If you're looking at this from a viewpoint of conversion, then you want to be asking yourself, are we adding like conversion elements? Something we've been trying out most recently is to start having like banners, CTA banners that relate to the content piece. And not just any CTA banners using testimonials from our clients or using words that they've shared with us in a case study. So that it is the customer's own words shouting from the rooftop how awesome our tool is. I would say that's something that everybody else should try. Have testimonials on your content as a way to reinforce authority. And then the placement of those testimonials should be in positions where you are talking about that specific solution or that specific problem, because then it's more powerful. I would also say have more in-text CTAs, have more in-text banners, and make sure that whatever you're linking to in your content is relevant to
what they clicked on.
Exactly, to what they clicked on. So if you're doing all of these things, it's very difficult for the content not to be converting, honestly. Then if you're still not getting the results that you're looking at, you want to look at it from what is trending right now around this content. Has the intent changed? Because that happens sometimes. Has the information changed due to a trending event or something that is happening or something that is coming? Do we need to change the content because of that to make it adaptive? That's where the adaptive element comes in. I feel like we're going to be getting so many changes in 2024 and we need to stay agile to just meet up with all of these changes. So you need to be asking yourself that. So if the intent has changed, that means that the content has to change also to match that intent. Or maybe you need to just update it to make it better than what exists out there.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, this is a great time of year going into 2024 to think about, just, you can't just set it and forget it, right? So have those reviews internally or with yourself to look at the content. Is it performing to where you expected it against your goal? Is it, are you below or above where you wanted to be? If you're above, okay, how can we maybe supercharge that and maybe put some paid ad spend behind it and really supercharge it?
Yeah.
If it's not performing, to your point there, that's not a bad thing. It just means that the tides may have changed and, you know, whatever else. So is it landing? Is it the wrong message at that time? So, but again, continual improvement. And that's kind of what Evolve's about. Evolve Your Business is our business name, right? So you can't just do something and just leave it. You have to keep building with it. So
I would add one more last one, is to make sure you're collecting feedback. I think there are so many tools that allow you to like put like a tiny feedback form at the bottom of the page, and maybe like those ones that like score and say how helpful was this content. That's actually a really good way to gauge content effectiveness. You can just have that, put that score there, and people can rate it on a scale of 1 to 5, or you can just have the feedback form, that tiny form, and they can give you like their feedback based on how helpful the content was. That's another great way to like gauge effectiveness of what you're putting out there.
Love it. So, Chima, thank you so much for that. This has been great. As we look to close, I do have a few more questions, if that's okay. I know you've worked in SEO and content for a few years now. What drew you to this field? And is there anyone in particular that inspired you or that you would like to thank in that space?
I wish I could give some great motivational answer. But the truth was that I came into SEO by mistake, like most people. I was literally just Googling the internet one day, and then I saw this gig that said copywriter wanted. And I applied, I got it, and then I started out as a copywriter. But I realized that the stuff I really enjoyed doing was when we were doing SEO tasks, like keyword research, doing like scraping entities and NLP with text rays, all of all that stuff. I really, really enjoyed it. And when I decided to go solo, that was what I wanted to focus on, because it was the stuff that came easy to me. So I'm always all for doing the stuff that's easy, because that means that I'm enjoying it. And that means that this is my passion. So initially, I was just doing like generic content, all that stuff. And then during the pandemic, I decided to like make my niche SEO content strategy, all that stuff. So it started as a mistake, just finding myself in here by accident. And then it became something I fell in love with. But I would attribute a lot of my success to blogs, because I was self-taught and I learned a lot by reading. In the early days, Neil Patel.
Mm-hmm.
Moving forward, I would say Moz Blog, Search Engine Journal, Search Engine Land, a lot of content from Aleida Solis. She shares so much helpful stuff on social media. So these are like the core resources that I was consuming to learn the basics of SEO and content. And then the rest I learned by building my own website and then using my website as a test ground, seeing what worked, and then implementing that on client websites.
And I get so something about the SEO community, it's so sharing. Like they share what they learn, right? And there's a really nice community around it. Obviously Brighton SEO, which was recently in San Diego as well. So it's a great community to be in.
I feel like if you follow the right people who are just all about giving knowledge, like Aleida, who has the Learning SEO platform, she has the Calling Monday, she even has like I think a cohort kind of thing going on now where she just brings someone in and they just teach something every week. If you want to like, if you just want to learn the basics of SEO, I will start with Aleida Solis. She has so many great resources. I would also go to like Search Engine Journal. They have incredible foundational content, and Content Marketing Institute is another one. I left that out, but that was somewhere that I spent a lot of time in the early days when I was still learning.
Great. Well, thank you. And in terms of your tech stack, so obviously that's something that you've talked about, AI quite a lot, and obviously Moz will sit in there. This will be quite interesting because obviously we typically ask about sales tech stack, but you can share what's in your sales tech stack. MarTech stack would be good to hear what you have there.
I used to have too many redundant tools that I was not even really using, and I was paying for it yearly. But I've kind of like brought them like this. It went from really big to very tiny, because a lot of the stuff I was using those tools for, I can now use ChatGPT for them. So thank goodness. But what's in my tech stack right now? I would say Moz, obviously, for like keyword research, a lot of all those SEO stuff. I also have, there's this tool I use for content optimization that I have unfortunately forgotten the name of right now in this very moment. What else? I would say buffer for scheduling social media. Yeah. A lot of my stuff is around social media and content. So yeah, really, to be honest, a lot of it is Moz for keyword research, Slack for communications, Google Gmail for emails, ChatGPT for 50% of the stuff I'm doing,
yeah.
And buffer for scheduling. Buffers for scheduling social media content, because I use a lot of social media to do thought leadership content.
Yeah, but Buffer's great, and there's a free plan, and obviously it scales up. So yeah,
highly
recommend Buffer. Are there any books that you would recommend to people reading? Obviously, that either inspired you this week, or not this week, this year, or next year.
The one I'm reading right now.
Ah, nice. Is that
Extended.
Cialdini, is that his name?
Yes, Cialdini.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to find it myself.
The book is so good. Influence, the Psychology of Persuasion. I feel like if you do sales, if you do anything that has to do with understanding how humans think and how we make decisions and the power of influence, this is a great book for it. I've just been sharing my learnings on social media slowly, but I think I would like to compile all the stuff I'm learning from this book into one big mega thread. It's such an incredible book. So definitely, I would advise you to read Influence, The Psychology of Persuasion by Robert Cialdini. I think I even have a blog post I wrote a few years ago on my website when I was still new in the game based on this book.
It is awesome. I was just looking for it here. It might be next to my bed, which is a good bedtime reading. A favorite Moz use case?
I'll say, there's a few. If you're trying to do determine what makes a good backlink, that's the first one. That was what I started using Moz for. When I'm trying to gauge a website I'm trying to build backlink for, you can just use that Moz tool and then see the spam score. You can go in there and see if it's an active website that is actually putting out content. You can see if they're also building backlinks. Just use that to gauge your website and see if this is a good domain that you want to be building a backlink for. Another one is doing competitor analysis. If you don't know your competitors and you're trying to discover your competitors, you can just plug in your website and then Moz will automatically generate a few competitors. And that gives you somewhere to start from if you're in a completely new niche. And then you can now do that competitor research. It pulls out keyword list based on what your competitors are ranking for, and then you can just use that to do your first keyword research. Also, for building clusters, Moz automatically automates clustering keywords into groups, and then you can even filter and say, okay, I want to do generic grouping or more niche grouping, depends on what you're looking for. That filtering option is just powerful. Also for doing keyword research, building backlinks, finding out what makes a good domain, I would say that these are my use cases. But also for ongoing monitoring, you can create a campaign, putting a website in there, and then every week it's sending you feedback and telling you what's going on with your website, if you've lost some backlinks, if you've gained new backlinks, if you're ranking for new keywords, all that good information. Moz can provide that for you if you do a campaign. But personally, what I mostly use Moz for: backlinks, SEO research, competitor research, and learning more about the domain.
Mm. Well, Chima, this has been awesome. Thank you very much. Is there anything else in particular you'd like to say before we go today?
No, I'll just like you say one thing. Back to where we started from. Going into 2024, you need to be training your team on how to use AI just to make sure that they're not putting out regurgitated nonsense out there in your brand name, and to make sure that they are using it the right way. If you take nothing away from this whole conversation, remember that.
And what's the best way to stay up to date with you? Obviously, do you mind us sharing your social handles?
Yeah, I'm on socials. I'm on Instagram. Sorry, not Instagram. I'm on Twitter and LinkedIn with my name, Chima Medjie.
Yeah.
And you can find me on my personal website, zenithcopy.com. You can also learn about the nonprofit that I lead called the Freelance Coalition. The website is freelancecoalition.org, or you can learn more about Moz on moz.com.
Perfect. We'll have links to everything there.
Yes.
And Chima, is it Chima dot Mecha? Look, is it just your name? Is there a dot in between with your?
My Twitter name is Chima Meje.
Yeah.
At Chima Meje. My LinkedIn name is Chima Meje. Cool. I try to keep it simple so that I'm easily findable.
I like it. I've got one of those. I've got some friends that say to me, how have you not got any numbers after your name on your social handles?
No.
Just get in there early. That's the way to do.
Yeah.
But Chima Meje, so it's
Chima Meje. Yes.
So thank you very much. And we'll have links to all of that, as well as links to try Moz for yourself going into the new year. But that is it for this week. Thank you for listening to Evolve Pipedrive Podcast, where we talk all things Pipedrive, sales, apps and Pipedrive Marketplace in order to help you grow your business. At Evolve, we're a technology consultancy based in the UK, working globally, specializing in helping scaling businesses do more with Pipedrive and their wider tech stack through implementation, consultancy and training. If you found this useful, please let us know what you think in the comments, hit like, subscribe and share with somebody you think will find this useful. We value all of your feedback. Chima, thank you.
Thank you so much, Bruce.
Cheers now.